want harira. Again, we have another idgham.
Both are idgham al ghunnah.
Yeah. Shamsan wa la zamharira. Daniyatan alayhim. We have ilhar of nun sakina.
Yeah, here nun is completely pronounced.
Yeah.
Due to actually the huruf al halqiyah.
Yeah. And then we have other rules of nun sakina. Min fillatin.
That is here ikhfa.
Ikhfa.
And
wa
that
akwabin,
would you talk about the ikhfa,
yes,
how it is applied?
The nun sakina is not pronounced from its original place of articulation. Instead, you have to approximate the place of articulation of fa. By approximation, we mean the articulator should get close to the place of articulation of
fa
without touching it. It should be held in that position for two vowel counts, while making
a nasal sound.
Which are nasalized as well.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق فيه محاسن الأخلاق هو القرآن.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about Islam. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. Peace and greetings from Tehran. You're listening to Iran Radio. And today's programming is more than just the schedule. Of course, it's an invitation to reflect, to learn, and to feel connected. Let's begin. First, it's a new segment of radio productions. Then we tuned into A to Z of Life. Next, it's time for Israel Watch to round out the hour. Keep it locked in. We've got more for you.
Detention and refugee centres in Samos suffer from severe overcrowding, where many refugees and migrants are detained for long periods, creating inhumane conditions. These individuals often face difficulty in accessing basic healthcare, psychological care, and adequate food. Before the establishment of the new camp or detention center on the Greek island of Samos, the situation for refugees there was extremely difficult. They lived in harsh conditions in the old camp near the town of Vathi, which suffered from severe overcrowding. The old camp was originally designed to accommodate around 650 people, but at times housed more than 7,000 refugees. Many refugees were forced to live in inadequate tents in the areas surrounding the camp, adding to their suffering. Additionally, there was a shortage of clean drinking water and sanitation, leading to the spread of diseases. Other challenges included long queues for food with insufficient rations, a lack of healthcare services, leaving refugees with untreated medical issues, frequent violence and clashes, both among refugees and between them and the police, weak protection for women and children, with reports of harassment and even assaults, extremely long waiting periods, sometimes lasting years, before receiving decisions on asylum applications. This delay increased frustration and made life in the camp even more difficult. What happened next? The new closed camp was opened in September 2021, offering better infrastructure, but operating under strict surveillance, similar to detention centers. This has sparked widespread controversy among human rights organizations.
The volume of the need for health medical consultation is really high, because it's not just a population that is stable in a camp, it's a population that is turning, the turnover is very high. You've got hundreds of people leaving every month, being transferred to another camp, and then hundreds of people arriving and in need of new consultation. So we have a team of doctors and we try to provide this consultation, but we also have limited capacity. And ultimately, there is a state responsibility to provide medical care to those people. It's a state's responsibility, but it's also a responsibility that comes from the EU and the European leaders. So that is really a one-man challenge, the volume and the need for primary health care. Another challenge is also the referral in case of specialized care. On some islands, there is no access to some specialized care. There is no psychiatric care, for example, or there is no access to certain infectious disease treatments such as HIV, tuberculosis, or hepatitis. That means that when we identify someone that is in need for specialized care that is not available on the island, then we have to liaise with the authority to organize a timely transfer so the person can actually receive the care needed. And this also can be sometimes a little bit complicated.
In 2024 in Samos, we assisted more than 2,400 people arriving, and we have witnessed stressful and very distressed as the arriving of the people. Psychological and medical issue mainly resulting from their severe experiences during their journey, but also as well pregnant women who need of emergency medical care.
Number of administrative challenges, but they're faced mostly, our patients face a number of administrative challenges, and therefore indirectly when trying to provide them or trying to support them to receiving medical care, then we are also faced with those challenges. It really often comes to bureaucratic barriers, difficulty to register someone, or legal barriers as well. In terms of access, we've had challenges in the past, absolutely. It's been actually better recently. No one has a crystal ball to say what the future holds, really. I think we need hope in whatever situation. And I also think that actually hope, as I was saying earlier, the instinct for life actually is very, very strong, and it's part of the human nature. But I think we need to be under no illusion, because when you look at the already with actually numbers that are not that high, when you look at how the system is overwhelmed and struggling to actually uphold with the basic assistance and services that people need. And then you look at the broader international context at the moment with the increased restrictive frame for migration in general. You have a rise of anti-migrant narratives all over the world. So I think we also need to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Many young people and families from Arab countries seek refuge in Europe due to wars, poverty, repression, and political instability in Middle Eastern countries caused by Israeli colonization in Palestine, supported by the United States and the European Union. Israel's occupation has extended to encroach on neighboring countries like Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, which poses a real threat to these countries, delaying their economic and developmental progress. This spreads poverty and unemployment, pushing young people to migrate to support their families. These migrants attempt to reach Europe via the Mediterranean Sea, a perilous journey. Unfortunately, this situation results in the loss of many lives and reflects the extent of desperation felt by these migrants under the current conditions.
أسباب اللجوء الأولى يعني هي مواضيع الحرب.
The main reasons for seeking asylum often stem from wars, as refugees witness destruction and tragedies firsthand. When someone sees their loved ones dying in front of them and can do nothing to save them, their only option is to seek refuge elsewhere, where they can receive financial support and shelter. Many people live in tents, as we have recently seen when the winds blew them away, leaving families exposed and increasing their suffering. The situation of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon is very similar to that of Syrian refugees. They need residency permits that last for 6 or 7 months, sometimes up to a year, and often their applications get rejected in the end. If accepted, they receive a travel permit within 20 days to a month and a half, after which they rely on God and continue their journey, even if it means facing great risks. As for the journey across the sea, it is an experience filled with death and danger. I have gone through it twice. The first time was in 2015, when we stayed at sea for 7 hours. I also tried to travel through Libya, but the attempt failed. In another attempt, we spent 72 hours at sea and saw death with our own eyes. There were 107 of us on board, and the suffering is indescribable. Only those who have lived through it can truly understand the tragedy.
Palestinians, scattered across the world, often express their love for Palestine by saying they carry their homeland in their hearts, not in their passports. Every camp, every city, every distant street is only temporary until they return. When asked about their dreams, they answer without hesitation, to return.
I am from the city of Aled. My mother is from Tulkarem. And my father was among those displaced following the massacre that took place in Lida in 1948. The Lida massacre is one of the most horrific crimes ever committed. For the Zionist militias, it was essential to take control of the Palestinian airport and railway system in order to establish their entity. They turned those infrastructures into Israeli institutions, aided by militias that came from all across Europe. These facts are not forgotten. In 2021, just before the Dignity Uprising and the Sword of Jerusalem battle, I was watching a short documentary about Lida. It's hard to find much information about the city, and as I grew older, I started to search for the meaning of Lida. I found very little, especially about the massacre. Even though the Israeli Supreme Court released many documents related to various massacres, the Lida massacre remained shrouded in secrecy, which indicates the sheer horror of what happened there. Among the things I watched was a film about a group of Palestinian children in Lida who didn't speak Arabic and didn't know what Palestine was. It clearly showed the extent of the Israelization of the city and how Palestinian identity was being systematically erased. That day, I cried deeply. I felt there might be hope for some Palestinians in Nablus or Haifa to return. But for us, the people of Lida, there was no hope. Just 2 weeks later, the Sword of Jerusalem battle erupted. On May 10th, 2021, Lydda became the first Palestinian city within the 1948 borders to rise up and liberate itself for 3 days, along with Acre and Beersheba. At that time, the settlers fled in terror, almost naked, from their homes. As a Palestinian from Lydda, I say, every Palestinian has a story, and I belong to the third generation, my grandfather, my father, and now me. Ours is the generation that was meant to forget Palestine, but I was part of the generation that saw Lydda rise again, even if only for 3 days. I witnessed the flood with my own eyes, and I saw how people in exile, whether in America or Amman, speak of return.
I am a Palestinian refugee, and the right of return is not just a slogan to me. It is a promise that does not expire. My grandparents were forced to leave their homes, but the keys to our houses are still in our hands, and our hearts remain tied to that land. Palestine is not just a memory, it is a future we strive for every day. We will return, because in our souls we never truly left.
One of the most heartbreaking scenes in the Gaza War occurred during the temporary truce, when refugees began returning from the south to northern Gaza. They were not walking toward their homes. They were walking toward a dream. Nothing awaited them there but rubble, and there was no guarantee the skies would remain calm. Still, they returned.
I painted a scene when the people of Gaza returned from the south to the north, a majestic sight, the sea to their left, destruction to their right, and they were walking toward their homes. It was the first time I had ever witnessed a Palestinian return. It was then that I realized the whole world does not want the Palestinian to return, and that the Palestinian is the only one who does. I came to understand that the Palestine we will return to will not be the same as the one our parents described. It may no longer carry the scent of oranges and jasmine, but we will return despite the destruction. We have been killed for 100 years, and we will be killed even more the closer we get to returning. But I am ready for every kind of return, no matter what it looks like. Recently, I was speaking with my friend about the massacres in Gaza. He said to me, "Which of us Palestinians hasn't experienced genocide? The mothers of the martyrs who wear their sons' photos over their hearts, these women too have experienced genocide. The moment their sons were martyred was their moment of annihilation. There is no Palestinian family that has not endured genocide. Even those who were not displaced witnessed their loved ones being displaced and killed, and then they were subjected to psychological, economic, and social persecution. There is no Palestinian who has not lived through a massacre. And to anyone who says the Palestinians sold their land, I challenge them to be put in the same position and then see whether they would choose to die in their home or raise their children in exile. No one should have to choose between death and displacement. But that is the only choice we were given."
There is a steady increase of people arriving to seek protection and asylum in Greece since 22. So I may not recall exactly the numbers, but I think in 23 there was around 48,000 people that arrived, newly registered asylum seekers. 24, I think it's above 60, 62, if I'm not saying something wrong. So The increase is not that enormous, and we are really far from the numbers of 2015 or 2016. I think that's also very clear. But yet, we really see a steady increase year after year since 22. And that's also something that we see on the ground, because although the numbers are not that high, there is this increase, and it is completely overwhelming the system in place.
Percent are men, and 99% are women, and 38% are children. The population in the camp is way above the official capacity, which forces people to live in areas that are not accommodate for living. So the population in the camp is way above the official capacity. So people are forced to live in areas that are not suitable for accommodation. So living conditions are really appalling. So we can see people living in the floor with no blankets. There is pest infestation, some toilets and some bathroom being flooded or broken. That is really not suitable for the person, and even more for the more vulnerable one. So this living condition will really contribute to the spread of preventable diseases, especially skin diseases, gastrointestinal illness, and respiratory infection. And as we say, there is very vulnerable people within the camp, including children.
Clashes with the Coast Guard often occur, further increasing the danger of the journey and placing migrants in a difficult position between the hope of reaching safely and the threats from authorities. The journey itself, although seemingly just a maritime trip between two points, represents a continuous challenge for survival and is usually followed by great suffering for the migrants in terms of humanitarian conditions and basic needs.
The sea is dangerous, but the bigger danger is not in it, but in the coast guards who chase us. Even if the waves are high, we can cross with the skill of the captain, but the problem lies with the Turkish and Greek naval patrols. If we don't stop for them, they deliberately sink the boats. Their goal is to stop migration by any means. That is why people are forced to sail, even in the toughest weather conditions, because the coast guards do not appear during storms. I attempted to cross the sea 8 times and saw death each time. Many children, women, and young people have lost their lives because of the coast guards, who shoot at us, take our belongings, and then send us back into the water, where we wait for the Turkish Navy to rescue us.
Greek islands are a key crossing point for illegal migrants, especially islands like Lesbos, Chios, and Samos. These islands are located near the Turkish coasts, making them initial stops for many migrants attempting to reach Europe. From there, many try to continue their journey to other countries like Germany, France, and Sweden. Unfortunately, migrants often face risks during these trips, such as drowning due to unsafe boats or being arrested by Greek or European authorities. Additionally, the Greek islands face immense pressure due to the continuing increase in migrant numbers, which impacts their resources and creates social and economic challenges.
I didn't choose Samos Island, but I chose Greece because it is the only passageway to Europe, specifically Germany and Belgium. Our goal was not to stay in Greece, but to transit to our final destination.
The policy of detention on Greek islands has faced severe criticism from humanitarian organizations and the international community. The Greek government and European countries that adopt strict policies regarding asylum and migration have been accused of exacerbating the suffering of refugees and migrants in these centers. Many international organizations call for the improvement of detention conditions by reducing overcrowding, transferring refugees to better centers, providing necessary health care for all detainees, ensuring the protection of human rights, and providing a safe environment for women and children.
We hear stories constantly about how the violence is affecting the well-being and the psychological state of the people. But we also hear a lot how being contained in camps that resemble a prison, with this very high level of security, with the barbed wires on the top of the fence, so many security officers everywhere, how it's also, in a way, re-traumatizing them again. So we address, from a psychological point of view, those sufferings. And one challenge, actually, is to find the balance between having a one-off session and a longer psychological support, because people also don't necessarily stay so long in the camp. Sometimes after a few months, they may be going and being transferred to another camp. So the follow-up is also sometimes an issue in the provision of medical care.
European destinations, particularly countries like Italy, Greece, and Malta, are often the goal for migrants across the Mediterranean. In the absence of legal migration opportunities, many young people turn to traffickers to organize illegal migration trips. These trips continue to present major safety challenges, as many migrants risk drowning or being arrested by European authorities. To limit illegal immigration from the Middle East to Europe requires addressing the root causes of conflicts and disputes in the region. One of the biggest of these issues is the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which contributes to the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Palestine and the region in general. Achieving peace in West Asia will inevitably lead to improvements in the security and economic situation in the region. There will be no justification for migration. Despite the injustice faced by the Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli occupation, such as arbitrary arrests, home demolitions, and city blockades, they remain firmly rooted in their land. Resilience has become a part of their daily lives. They confront oppression with hope and cling to their narrative despite attempts to erase it. To them, the land is not just a place, it is history and an undeniable right. With every new generation, the spirit of resistance is renewed, and the determination to remain grows stronger, as if declaring to the world, "We are here, and we will remain." The international community has a responsibility to recognize the rights of the Palestinian people, including their right to self-determination and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. It must exert political and diplomatic pressure to ensure that Israel respects international law. In addition, there is a duty to support legal accountability by backing the efforts of the International Criminal Court in investigating war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories. Providing humanitarian assistance is also essential, particularly for Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and for refugees living abroad.
You're maker of my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, physical suffering. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Jewish Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And, you know, the topic of physical suffering is, it's a very big and important one. It's something that all of us talk about very much, because obviously we talk about physical suffering in terms of, you know, what is the reason behind physical suffering? Why do we have to go through physical suffering? And what can we gain, in a sense? What wisdom can we gain from physical suffering? How do we deal with it? How do we understand it in terms of our faith, even? But I just want to... So there's a specific thing also about physical suffering and how we ourselves respond to it, or sometimes even don't respond to it visibly. So I'm going to just mention something from the life of one of the martyrs from the whole defense, the name of Saeed Janbuzorgi. So he is one of the martyrs who died after the Holy Defence of basically horrible injuries sustained during the Holy Defence. And so he was suffering more and more from these war injuries. So basically he was in constant pain, but he still wouldn't complain. So his daughter was still quite young and would cry a lot. But he didn't say a thing. He didn't really complain to his wife, didn't say anything to the children. And even when, so the pain got so strong that the pain was actually visible in his eyes, so to his wife, but he wouldn't say anything. And yeah, so we have to ask ourselves, so what level of, resilience and patience and strength is this? And actually also love, so love for the children in particular. But I'll talk about this a little bit more. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Trade with me, Sister Zainab, and talking about this attitude that some people do have, which is to, you know, withstand physical suffering to such an extent that they still lead their lives. They don't really let on to other people how much pain they're in, and there might be very good reasons. You may be that at times in our lives there may be reasons, times where we actually need to talk about the pain we're in so that we can actually say, well, look, obviously there's something serious, I need to go and access a doctor, whatever. And then there are those times where, you know, we maybe keep it quiet because we do not want to be cause undue worry to other people. And this especially concerns, let's say, parents. They don't want to sort of, let their children know how much they're suffering, let their spouses know, or even other family members know how much they're suffering, for example. And then also, because they're also doing this. So, for example, if we're in great pain, we might also be a bit more prone to being what we would call reactive, which is reactive is a bit different to being responsive. Reactive is, you know, you can imagine if we're in pain, we might be more likely to snap, to say angry words, because, you know, maybe it's difficult. If the pain is really high, really big, then, you know, we might get more irritable more easily. But many people, alhamdulillah, and may Allah bless them, are able to sort of still control themselves and just use kind words towards other people. And obviously this is something that the martyr, Jan Bozorgi, was able to do, and, you know, this is... And, you know, obviously, that, as I just said, there are times where we really need to be honest about the pain we're in. Because to some extent, if people are in great pain and have a really serious disease, you know, we need to tell people so that obviously care can be arranged. But obviously, if we're still able to contribute in our families, in our society, still able to perform in the workplace, and if we're able to somehow access that level of patience and resilience even towards pain, and still in a sense have that goodwill, have that love, have that compassion, and just that smile on our faces for the people around us, there's a huge blessing if we're able to access that level of, in a sense, resilience. So inshallah, all of us can access that if we're in the position where, you know, we really need to be doing that. And that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on I'm Being Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
thank you for joining us. Hebrew Media highlighted a number of topics that its commentators focused on, including Iran's decision to suspend the Cairo agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the ongoing negotiations between Netanyahu's administration and the Golani administration, the Israeli aggressive escalation against Lebanon, and the situation in the occupied West Bank. These issues will be the focus of discussion in this episode with Dr. Mohammad Swaydan, academic and writer in international affairs. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohammad. Iran's decision to halt the Cairo agreement concerning cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency following the agency's biased measures against Iran was discussed in the Hebrew media, as commentators considered that Iran's position adds complexity to the situation. What's your opinion about the Israeli commentator's comment when he said that Iran's decision to suspend the Cairo agreement for cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency will prevent knowing the truth or the true state of enriched uranium?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons I have said before that the 12-day war was a mistake from the Israeli side, because before the 12-day war, the Israelis, the Americans, they had a good pack of information about Iran's nuclear program.
Yes.
And let's add for them, they had also people that work with them inside of Iran that was giving them also additional information. So there were two channels of information, the official channel from the IAEA and the unofficial channel to the people who work with Israel or the US inside of Iran. After the 12-day war, the Iranians caught a lot of people that work with the Israelis, so the unofficial channel almost stopped. And the official channel today also stopped. So the vagueness about the information regarding Iran's energy program is now much more than it was before. And that's one of the main reasons.
And how dangerous is that to the Israelis?
That's
lack
of
information.
Yes, that's one of the main things that let the Israelis today feel threatened, because when you treat Iran as one of the most major enemies, or the most major enemy in the region,
mm-hmm.
and you lack the information about it, that's when you feel threatened. Because it's one thing to know what your enemy has, but it's another thing to not know anything about what he has. And that's why I think that's why Israel will be driven towards an escalation with Iran very near or in the near time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't know what Iran has, and it's afraid that Iran increases its capacity, its ability, exactly, and its capabilities without it knowing.
And they even lack information concerning nuclear facilities, not only enriched uranium.
Everything regarding the nuclear program today is vague. For the US.
Okay, but what are the repercussions of Iran's suspension of Cairo's agreement concerning, of course, the facilities?
I think mainly they are limited. Why? Because already everything the West can do have done, and especially returning back to the sanctions. So when the West returned to the sanctions, when the war already happened, so everything the West can do will have done. I think that one of the main possibilities in the near future is to return towards a certain kind of escalation between Israel and Iran,
mm-hmm.
something similar to the 12-day war, because in my opinion, the 12-day war's goal was mainly to get rid of the power inside of Iran. This wasn't achieved. Today, they want to repeat something similar, and they have an extra reason to do with it. To do it is that they have no information about what Iran is doing inside its borders.
Okay. However, the negotiations between the Netanyahu and the Golan administration have not yet reached a result regarding the security agreement between the two sides, simply because the Israelis insist on not withdrawing from the points they occupied in southern Syria. And they conditioned withdrawal from some of them and on signing a full normalization and peace agreement between the two parties. Do you think that Netanyahu's insistence on occupying the Syrian land and not withdrawing from them might sabotage the negotiations between Tel Aviv and Damascus?
No, I don't think that, because mainly Ahmad al-Sharaa is willing to give Netanyahu whatever he wants. So I don't think that it's in the hands of the Syrians. I think it's in the hands of the Israelis, because if you see what have been happening since the collapse of the Assad until now, it's always the Israelis that are not sending clear messages regarding what they want. They are very clear that they don't need negotiations.
Okay,
they
but then why we did not have an agreement yet?
Because
why
the Israelis don't want an agreement. the Israelis are forced by the Americans to go and participate in the negotiations now. But these negotiations, but the Israelis don't want to reach an agreement based on these negotiations. So although Ahmed al-Sharaa have given them everything they want, everything they have asked for have been given by Ahmed al-Sharaa, but they are still finding reasons to not reach an agreement. The only way for an agreement to be signed between Damascus and Tel Aviv is if Trump pressures Netanyahu towards this agreement, like he did in Gaza. If he didn't do that, then I think that more stagnation will continue. Netanyahu will just buy time and continue occupying inside of Syria and targeting places inside
of
Syria.
But what does Israel want from Syria?
It doesn't. It wants it to stay in the same way it is now, divided.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmed al-Sharaa not having control, because Netanyahu doesn't want Ahmed al-Sharaa to have control over Syria. He thinks that if I gave him an agreement, he will have more control, and he will send a message to the Syrians that I am the one who brought peace to Syria.
Yeah.
So Netanyahu,
they don't want him empowered.
They don't want him empowered. They want.
But they already occupied the territories that they feel that it's part of Greater Israel. What more do they need inside
it's
Syria?
It's not about only territories. Territory is one of the goals. The main goal is for Syria to stay divided, for Ahmed al-Sharaa to stay weak, for Israel to still have the ability to act inside of Syria whenever it wants.
Mm-hmm.
So Israelis think about, I took all what I want without an agreement. Why force myself towards an agreement? I already occupy. Mm-hmm. I already have.
Do you think that Trump will force an agreement?
Not in the current phase, but later on, yes. Because
okay.
Trump believes that an agreement with Syria, an agreement with Lebanon, will lead to an agreement with KSA, Saudi Arabia.
Which
so
is the utmost normalization target.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's listen to some of the commentary on Israeli social media calling for continued occupation of Syria.
Haniel Aviv, it is impossible to guarantee that there are no light weapons or combat means in Syria, so we must be present on the ground and occupy buffer zones and security belts inside Syria. Yoni Ben Menachem, there is no evidence that Syria has opened a new page with Israel, and one cannot speak of a new peaceful Syria while the Druze are being killed. Harif and Makshi, Syria must be divided into four states, Druze, Kurdish, Alawite, and a Golan state. We must do everything we can to ensure Syria remains weak and failed.
Moving to the occupied West Bank, where occupation forces and Zionist settlers continue their attacks against Palestinian villages, raising fears of an explosion of the situation in the West Bank and calls to stop these assaults. Why do you think that settlers are escalating their own attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank at this time specifically?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the following. This guy spoke about that the ministers aren't speaking because of political calculations. It's not about political calculations. It's about the Israeli community moving towards far right. It's about the Israeli community being fascist.
Mm.
So when Smotrich doesn't condemn or speak about what the settlers are doing, it's not because he is thinking about his political goals. It's because what they are doing reflects what he believes. It's because what these settlers are doing reflects what more than 50-60% of
they
the Israeli community is. So they are far right. They believe that they should just go and kill the Palestinians.
So leadership is reflected in the community.
Exactly. And that's why Netanyahu has been able to do whatever he wants in Gaza. That's why today the settlers can do whatever they want in the West
mm-hmm.
Bank. That's why Israel can kill whatever it wants from the Palestinians, because the Israeli community accepts it. And one very good evidence is that even the parents of the Israeli prisoners, when they were with Hamas, when they got their children back, they asked Netanyahu to continue the war. Previously, they were asking him to stop the war because it's leading to killing the Israeli soldiers.
The same families.
The same families that their prisoners returned to them. When they had their prisoners with them, they asked Netanyahu, go and kill more Palestinians. This is the Israeli community. So what's happening in the West Bank is reflecting the community. The silence of Israeli leadership is reflecting this far-right, fascist, Israeli drive inside of the entity.
Okay, we remain actually in the occupied West Bank, where settlement expansion, annexation projects, and land confiscation continue, issues that drew considerable attention in Hebrew media. What do you think about these claims, especially when they said that the Israelis are the original owners of this land, especially in the West Bank, and they are merely just reclaiming a land that's simply theirs through settlement and annexation projects?
Well, this is part of the narrative they used in 1948 to just come and occupy Palestine. So their own narrative is what this guy said, but I think it's much more than the narrative thing. It's today, I think in Israel you have several communities. The elderly who know that the narrative is fake, who know that the narrative isn't right. But you have the young that have been educated about this narrative. They believe in it. That's why if you see the polls,
yes,
you can find that the people who are young are more towards aggression than the people, the elderly one.
And that's exactly what it reflects what you were highlighting at the beginning of the episode when you were speaking, that they're moving towards the far right.
Exactly, and mainly the young people, because they have been educated this. They don't know the truth because they haven't been told the truth. All their mindset is being built based on the narrative that this is the land of Israel and the Palestinians are occupying parts of it, the West Bank and Gaza. But what does this mean for Israel? I think the same reasons that led for October 7th today are being repeated by the Israeli leadership, meaning that when you neglect what's happening inside of Gaza, when you neglect the high level of oppression inside of Gaza, you got October 7th. Mm-hmm. Today, the international community, the Israelis, are neglecting what's happening in the West Bank. And I think at a certain point, if Israel continues in this same way...
Okay, but this development of a community that is moving towards the far right, how will this impact the image of Israel on an international level?
It's not
because the same way that you are analyzing, a lot of people are actually observing this also. Would it affect it or it's okay?
No, it would affect it on three main levels. On the international level, today, if you speak with Europeans, if you speak with the Americans, if you speak with any country in the world, they are feeling afraid from the Israelis. One small example, during a football match in Aston Villa...
Isolation on the increase?
Yes, one football match in Aston Villa in England, in Britain, the Israelis weren't allowed to attend the football match because they are aggressive people. That's what the far right. On the regional level, today, the whole region is afraid of Israel because they know it's a fascist entity. And on the local level, today you have a diversion between the two political groups. The far right and the middle.
Okay, but there is still, whether in the United States, in America, or even in Europe, there are far right groups supporting Israel to the max.
Of course.
Even after all the genocide and the annexation and the corruption that we spoke about.
Of course, but when you want to analyze, we have to speak about the majorities and percentages. Today, previously didn't have any percentage that was against the far right inside of Israel. Today, inside the U.S., you can hear parts of Trump's administration speaking about Israel negatively. You can find the Democrats, you can find Europeans, you can find the stance of Spain. We didn't used to see these things before. They were seeing
them. Yes, and yesterday yesterday, Mamdani,
yes,
the mayor of New York, he was standing next to Trump while criticizing Israel vividly on all cameras, on international TV stations.
We didn't used to see this before. Well, moreover, when Mamdani reached the mayor of New York, this doesn't mean that there is a huge change inside of New York, but this means that...
Have we never seen that before?
It means that you can... the people in New York aren't more supportive toward Palestine, but it means that they are not more sensitive towards Israel.
Okay.
You can criticize Israel, but still reach power, and that's the major difference that happened.
Yeah, so no more taboos.
No more, exactly. Although Israel was one of the most sensitive topics, if you want
exactly
to reach power,
isn't that breaking
you
the
can,
ice?
Exactly, it's breaking the ice. It is a shift.
Okay.
Maybe not towards Palestine, but of course against Israel.
Okay, moving to the Israeli aggressive escalation against Lebanon, which the mayor of the Margaliot settlement near the southern Lebanese border considered absolutely necessary, saying coexistence with a hostile neighbor is almost impossible. From what the mayor of Margaliot said, it seems as if the occupation is getting ready to launch a war against Lebanon. Do you think this impression prevails within the Israeli entity?
Yes. Well, it's not about a war. I think not only inside of Israel, in all the region, it's known today that Israel is moving towards escalation with Lebanon. and everyone is speaking about it between today and January. So in the next 2 months, there is a sense of escalation that's going to occur between Israel and Lebanon. And what's the main reason of that?
Despite the fact that the occupation has not stopped attacking.
Escalation
took place there this week also.
Exactly. But he was speaking one of the most important narratives that we should take into consideration. He said that, well, we have been attacking and Hezbollah is arming and don't feel safe in the north. Well, the whole Israeli narrative in the war was that it entered the war to return the people, for the people in the north to return and feel safe.
Yes.
Till now, they don't feel safe, number one. Number two, Israel has been attacking Lebanon and saying to its people that I'm attacking Lebanon, I'm attacking Hezbollah to make it weak. And
could
suddenly,
this be just to justify war?
I think that Israel is going to move towards escalation because it has no information anymore. That's one of the main reasons. Israel has been targeting Hezbollah and telling its people that I'm targeting it to weaken it. Today, it's telling its people that Hezbollah is being stronger. So Israel been doing?
So you do believe that lack of information is what triggering a war?
Yes, because as we spoke about Iran at the beginning of the episode,
yes.
When you feel threatened, when you don't know anything about your enemy, because if I know what the enemy has capabilities, I will prepare myself, I could defend myself. But if I don't know what he has capabilities, that's the main problem. If I don't know his plans, that's the main problem. That's when you have a possibility to act, and when the possibility to act is higher when you feel threatened. I think in Lebanon, the same thing has happened. Since the end
so
of the war.
If they would have had information, they would have been silent.
No, they have been targeting it.
Okay. Dr. Mohammed Swaydan, academic and writer on international affairs, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
Warm greetings once again to all our dear listeners around the world. You're listening to Iran Radio. Iran Radio is here, and you are listening to some interesting facts about Islam. Muslims believe they are members of a worldwide Muslim community known as the Ummah, united by a religious bond that transcends tribal, ethnic, and national identities. The first mosque built in the U.S. was the Mother Mosque of America, which was built in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in 1934. It is still used for worship today. Let's see what this next hour holds. Coming right up, it's news this hour. Then we have Minbar. After that, tune in for another special session of radio productions. And closing the hours, don't miss Leader's Speech. Thanks for joining us. Up next, news this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top headlines. Tehran says as a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, the country will not back down on its right to have a peaceful nuclear energy program. Thousands take to the streets in the U.S. Capitol to voice their opposition to the administration's policies and call for the removal of President Donald Trump. And finally, the U.S. military is reportedly preparing to launch a new phase of operations targeting Venezuela, as Washington intensifies efforts to overthrow President Maduro. Hello. Hello and welcome everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Tehran says the American and Israeli military aggression on Iran's nuclear program back in June will not deter the country from seeking its right to peaceful nuclear energy.
Because of the